I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, This Is Your Brain on Politics. We'll look at neuromarketing. But first, to the Middle East. Secretary of Defense Condoleezza Rice is in the region trying to rescue the peace talks after Israel launched a military offensive in response to Hamas rockets fired from Gaza. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed, along with two Israeli soldiers and an Israeli civilian. Palestinian leaders suspended the peace talks after the bloodshed escalated last week. Rice said today, Hamas rocket attacks on Israel from Gaza must stop for the situation to improve, and she called on Palestinians to return to the talks. New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief Stephen Erlanger joins us now from Gaza City. Stephen, put this in context for us in the long history of this conflict. Is this different?
Well, what's different is confusion about how to make peace with the Palestinian people that's divided. The United States recognizes that the situation is deteriorating, at least on the Palestinian side of the equation, and it believes the chances for a two-state negotiated solution slip as Hamas, which controls Gaza now, where I am, grows in strength.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the militant group Hamas took over Gaza last summer, beating back the Palestinian forces loyal to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah, which now controls the West Bank. Abbas is calling for all sides to agree to a ceasefire, but does his voice carry weight in Gaza?
Very little, I'm afraid. There are people who obviously support him and support Fatah, but Hamas has pretty good control over Gaza, and I don't think it's going to end naturally. The United States and Israel believe in Mahmoud Abbas because of what he represents. He is the elected president of all the Palestinians. He believes in nonviolence. He believes in negotiations. He believes in a two-state solution. And Hamas believes in very few, if any, of those things. So for the United States to take sides is pretty clear. But in effective terms, the United States has no real answer either. I mean, the Bush people who would like to have a deal by the end of this year and who I very much doubt will get there somehow think that the idea of an agreement that can be put on a shelf and implemented over the next few years will be enough for Gaza to somehow fall back into the hands of Fatah, though in their heart of hearts they know that will only happen after Hamas is hit very hard by Israel and maybe even defeated militarily.
Well, meanwhile, we understand you're in the offices of Hamas right now in Gaza City. And as you write in the Times today, they told you that they're following the playbook of their Lebanese ally Hezbollah in its 2006 war with Israel. Explain more what they mean by that.
It's a little exaggerated, but, you know, Hezbollah, which is Shia, and Hamas is Sunni, but both oppose the peace process, they oppose Israel, and they have developed, in a way, little semi-states. One in southern Lebanon and one in Gaza. They combine both military activity, which they call resistance, and social activity, social welfare organizations on an Islamic model. And both are, in a way, waging war or, if you like, resistance with the use of rockets aimed at Israel. Hamas has also tried to learn how to fight an advanced army like Israel. What are the tactics to use? How do you fight underground? How do you fuse anti-tank rockets? How do you work within a civilian population or fight from within it? That's really the Hezbollah model.
Well, Hamas is also saying that, like Hezbollah, they've chased Israel out of Gaza since Israel pulled forces from northern Gaza yesterday. But we're wondering, what happens now? Is there a sense that Israel might launch a full-scale ground offensive? You say that the thinking might be that Hamas needs to be eliminated for anything to go forward. So what's your thinking?
There's a debate in Israel. Some say we cannot allow Hamas to create a southern Lebanon in Gaza and give it the credibility to do better on the West Bank, that Hamas is using the time to build an army, a real Palestinian army against Israel, and that we need to whack it back before it goes too far. And the only way we'll have peace is if we help the Palestinian Authority in the name of Mahmoud Abbas to restore authority over all of the Palestinian territories, including Gaza. And the other argument in Israel is Hamas is part of the Palestinian people. It's strong. It's here to stay. We can beat them. But then what do we do with Gaza? And that maybe the best thing to do is through the Egyptians or even through Mahmoud Abbas, try to negotiate a kind of informal ceasefire that would at least let the people of southern Israel not suffer rocket attacks all the time. But there are, as I say, people in the Israeli military who think that's a fool's errand, that Hamas is the enemy and needs to be defeated. So we'll see how that goes. It's an unresolved debate, but a very live one inside Israel.
Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times, speaking to us from in a Hamas office in Gaza City. By the way, Stephen, was that a call to prayer that we heard behind you?
Yes, you're still hearing it.
Yeah. Stephen, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And be safe.
Thank you so much. That I also appreciate.
Senator John McCain could wrap up the Republican nomination today. Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are in tight races in Texas and Ohio, and just in time for what they're calling Junior Super Tuesday presidential primaries, two new entries in the Democratic ad wars. Actor Jack Nicholson spliced together clips from his films in support of Hillary Clinton.
And now, folks, it's time for Who Do You Trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
And Black Eyed Peas frontman will.i.am assembled another group of celebrities for his third video in support of Barack Obama. It's called We Are the Ones.
We can change the world.
How'd you like them? Well, there are researchers who think they can tell you and the candidates how you liked these ads. It's the idea behind a growing technology called neuromarketing. Advertising executives use it now to gauge how well commercials work on consumers by monitoring their brain activity. And now researchers are using this technology on voters. Today we want to take a look at neuromarketing. We start with Dr. Stephen Sands of Sands Research, who is at the forefront of this technology. Dr. Sands, we know there are different techniques used. You use an EEG. How does it work?
We image the brain from the EEG. We record from multiple sensors placed on the scalp and visualize where in the brain the activity is coming from.
It's sort of a cap that your test voters wear. They put it on their head and they're wired up, and then you have them watch the ads.
That's correct.
Okay, well, we're online. You've posted some of the results of your test. You can see an ad, and right next to it, you can see how a brain reacts. So let's listen to a little bit of one. First, an ad from Barack Obama. It's very low-key. He talks about addiction to foreign oil and getting better fuel efficiency. Let's listen.
I went to Detroit to insist that we have to increase fuel efficiency standards. Now, I have to admit, the room got kind of quiet.
That's just a little bit from Barack Obama's ad. Dr. Sands, what am I seeing happening in the brain activity?
Well, primarily, you're seeing the parietal area of the brain, the back portion of the brain that puts together information and focuses our attention.
And it's not really that active.
That's correct. People were able to quickly assess as to what's going on.
Can you see from the brain activity whether people liked the ad?
No, we can't answer that question as to whether they like or dislike. We can only track their attention and perhaps some of their memory components to the task.
Well, let's listen to another one. This is Hillary Clinton on people being invisible to government. She's speaking before a group of people. It's intercut with images of her greeting voters and at work. Let's listen.
And I never thought I would see that our soldiers who serve in Iraq and Afghanistan would be treated as though they were invisible as well. Americans from all walks of life across our country.
A little bit of an ad from Hillary Clinton. Now, as I watch the brain scan on your website, Dr. Sands, on the other side of the ad, it's there are fireworks going on.
Yes, that's right. The addition of the music always enhances what they're looking at and listening to. The music does modulate the brain activity.
You know, what do we make of this if we can't really tell you know, there's not a big part of the brain that's lighting up for you, apparently, that says, I love this ad or I hate this ad, if I'm interpreting this correctly, then why do it?
Well, you can see within a given ad what parts are working effectively and what portions are not. And then one can sum up over the entire interval and compare as to how much attention was paid to a particular ad. So it's very valuable in terms of knowing how much engagement that you're associating with that spot.
Engagement is one thing, but how about negativity? Let's listen to a third ad. This is John McCain, and we remember this. It's when he criticized Hillary Clinton for asking for funding for a museum for Woodstock. Let's listen to a little.
That's why Citizens Against Government Waste calls John McCain a taxpayer hero. It's a matter of priorities. John McCain says, if you want to relive Woodstock, buy the record.
I'm seeing things firing in the brain activity, but what are you reading in that?
They are, again, responding to the music, and they are paying close attention, particularly when John McCain is walking with President Reagan. That's the peak of the ad. And so the ad worked very well. It's one of the top ads that we've recorded. And it was very good except for the very last part where they brought up an old graphic of the record, which a lot of the population didn't relate to.
It's funny, a vinyl record and boom.
It drops out.
Why is it better than a focus group, just sitting down and talking to people?
Well, people are very poor at introspection. When you are in a focus group or filling out a questionnaire, you're being asked to introspect into what's going on in your head. And if there's anything that we've learned over the last 100 years in research is people are very bad at that. And whereas looking at the direct responses, the direct physiological responses in the brain are much more direct.
We understand there can also be these kind of outbursts in parts of the brain that researchers know are associated with fear or disgust with something. Can you give us an example of when you've seen that?
Well, for example, in a let's take a dramatic accident in the Passat or Volkswagen ads, those spots were very recognizable to most people. This is the ad in which there was a crash, and that is going to activate fear and a startle response. But it has the opposite effect. It also has an effect on memory and what the ad was actually about. And it requires an individual to go back several times to see what the actual brand was being viewed.
Because seeing the accident triggered something that sort of blocked them remembering what the ad was even for.
Yes, there's a structure involved in the memory system called the amygdala, and it sits on the end of the area involved in memory, and it does color our experiences. It's what influences where were you during the Challenger disaster or when, if you're older, when President Kennedy was shot. We have outstanding memories for that event, but it also tends to overdrive the memory system, and you can have too much activation.
Dr. Stephen Sands of Sands Research, he uses neuromarketing to evaluate consumers and now voters' brain activity. For more on his website, you can go to oursherenow.org. Dr. Sands, thank you.
Thank you.
So how viable is all this? When we come back, we're going to check in with the neuromarketing blog. And later, will clean team interviews, re-interviews of terrorism suspects who'd been waterboarded, will that evidence be allowed in upcoming military trials? That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is about neuromarketing. It's an emerging technology that monitors brain activity, determine whether an ad is making an impression on consumers or voters, as we just heard. Roger Dooley publishes the Neuromarketing Blog. He's president of Dooley Direct. It's a consulting company. And Roger, we just heard from Dr. Stephen Sands. He, of course, runs another website that does this kind of research. He says this technology really needs to be used in concert with other tools. So how viable do you think it is?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. I heard part of Dr. Sands' interview, Robin, and I think he was very realistic in his expectations for what we can tell at the moment as far as whether an ad is truly effective or whether you're simply looking at some clues to how effective it might be. And I think that with time, by using other testing techniques in conjunction with neuromarketing, we'll be able to increase the predictive ability of those kinds of studies, whether it's additional physiological measures, for example, or simply measuring the performance of ads in the same way that a direct marketer might test the performance of a particular catalog cover.
Well, what do you mean by that? Tell us more about how you think neuromarketing might be made more effective.
I think the key thing, I spent 10 years in the direct marketing industry, and that was a truly scientific kind of marketing because you could vary just about everything. You could vary the catalog cover and offer letter. You could vary the placement of the products, how much space you devoted to them, and whether you included a photograph or a sketch or no photograph at all. And all of these things could be done on what's called a split-run test, where part of the customers get one version, part of the customers get another version. And then at the end of the day, the marketer can see that version A outperformed version B by 15% or 30% or whatever. And I think the same kind of work eventually needs to be done in the neuromarketing business, where rather than simply saying, gee, ad A lights up the brain a little bit more than ad B does, so it's probably better, actually doing that kind of split-run testing to determine that A outperforms B or vice versa.
To see what people actually buy or to see who they actually vote for.
Exactly.
To follow it through. Well, then tell us how many different ways this is happening. We heard about the EEG and a cap with electrodes and how Dr. Sands monitors the brains that way. We're reading about a company, MSense, for instance, that measures players' brain responses to video games. That's what they do. They can determine, we were just hearing from Dr. Sands, that you can find out if somebody's tuning out, turning off, because there's parts of the brain where you can register disgust. So this company determines if they've made their video games too gory, and they can pull back a little bit. What are some of the other techniques that are being used besides the electrodes?
I think the one that you hear most about is functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. And in that case, the subject goes into a big MRI tube that you may have seen in mostly in hospital settings, and their brain activity is measured in actual three dimensions. You can actually see which specific areas of the brain are lighting up and for how long. And the resolution of this is still a little bit crude. You can generalize the areas of the brain, but you can't certainly see it down to individual neurons yet. But the resolution's improving, and that's certainly one very important technology that's used a lot in neuromarketing and neuroeconomics research. I think that one of the drawbacks is that the fMRI environment is quite constraining. The subject is in a tube. They can't have any metal. So the way they can interact with their environment is quite limited.
Well, you know, this brings me to a reaction I'm guessing some people might be having to this idea of people trussed up, you know, while they're watching ads. You know, why invade people's brains? You know, why can't marketers just put your product or your candidate out in the marketplace and people, you know, let people meet them and buy, or, you know, according to whether or not the product performs? I mean, it feels so invasive.
Well, I think there are a couple of good reasons. First of all, an awful lot of advertising money is wasted. Ads simply don't perform. They don't drive customers to the stores or to buy the products or vote for the candidate or anything else. And I think that neuromarketing has the potential to avoid at least a little bit of that waste and make ads not so much make ads more effective as eliminate the losers that simply aren't going to have any impact at all.
Yeah.
And I think the more exciting prospect that directly addresses your question, Robin, is the possibility that neuromarketing could be used to improve the products themselves. That is, we heard Dr. Sands talk about how focus groups can be generally unreliable, although product developers tend to love focus groups to determine whether a product needs a particular feature or whether the curvy design is better than the square design and so on. Really, I think neuromarketing could be employed to help with some of those product choices and features and design and create a product that actually works better for the customer and the customer likes better, perhaps in ways that they can't verbalize. So I think that's the real promise, not so much just invading people's minds to make ads, sort of super ads
manipulative. But on the other hand, we just heard a Barack Obama campaign ad. It was an older one in which he talked about the issues. It didn't have any music or bells or whistles. And there was a beautiful Hillary Clinton ad that had beautiful music. We hear, too, that, you know, people may just be responding to the bells and whistles, to the music, to the picture of the flag, as opposed to what the candidate's saying. Shortly after that, Barack Obama changed from issues to the message of change. So perhaps some people wishing that maybe we could just have dull, straightforward ads that tell us about issues.
Well, I guess in a political context, that might be appropriate, but I think people want to enjoy their advertising. They want it to affect their emotions to some degree, or at least appeal to their emotions, and particularly for products. Product marketing tends to involve a lot of emotion and brand positioning, and so I don't think that you can ever eliminate the bells and whistles. And at the same time, neuromarketing isn't going to necessarily revolutionize advertising. Advertisers going back decades have known which ads can be effective, and there's certainly some great ad designers that have had that personal insight
from their gut.
Neuromarketing isn't going to improve that.
Right, from their gut. Roger Dulia publishes the Neuromarketing blog. He's president of Dooley Direct, the consulting company. And to find his blog, by the way, and learn more about this, go to our website, here-now.org. Roger, thanks so much. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
And still ahead today, speaking of things fascinating, did you know you can extract your own DNA right in your kitchen? We'll tell you how and other super cool science experiments. That's after the news, here and now. The CIA will be able to continue questioning terrorism suspects using techniques such as waterboarding because President Bush is refusing to sign legislation that would stop the harsh tactics. President Bush argues that current military regulations, which do ban waterboarding, are too restrictive for the CIA. Well, meanwhile, the Pentagon is preparing a special court system to try the first six Guantanamo detainees charged with crimes. So what will happen with evidence interrogators have gained through waterboarding? We recently spoke with Brent Mickham. He's representing Abu Zubaydah, one of three men waterboarded by the CIA. Mickham is concerned the evidence obtained through waterboarding will be sanitized.
What the government is attempting to do now is remove the taint by interviewing these guys who have been just tortured abysmally for years, and then interview them without torture and try and replicate the evidence. And my guess is that what the government will do is present us with the sanitized evidence and argue that there is no need to know any other evidence in the case.
Well, for more on all of this, we turn to Scott Silliman, Executive Director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University Law School. He's also a former military attorney and an expert on the military trials known as military commissions. He joins us from the Duke University radio studio. Professor Silliman, explain this to us. What is sanitizing?
Robin, the concept is that they will go back a second time and try to get a statement from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Ramzi bin al-Shib or al-Qahtani that was taken under more pleasurable circumstances, perhaps over some Starbucks coffee or a Dunkin' Donut, with the thought that therefore they would try to use that type of statement in evidence against them in a military commission.
You've said that these people that go in and re-interview detainees who've been waterboarded are called clean teams.
That's correct. And the concept is that they're trying to clean up whatever taint may be on that statement. Robin, under our constitutional law, you couldn't do this. There's what's called the fruit of the poison tree. You can't take a statement that is tainted by misconduct prior. But we just don't know whether the Constitution will apply to these military commissions at all. No court has made that decision yet.
Well, right now the Supreme Court is weighing whether Guantanamo detainees have constitutional rights. Do you think a decision from the Supreme Court might affect the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay?
It well could, Robin. Of course, the case that you're referring to, the Boumediene case, has to do with habeas corpus challenges to their detention. But if the Supreme Court in any way indicates that those at Guantanamo Bay have some measure of constitutional protection, it well could spill over into trial rights in the military commissions. But we're going to have to wait to see exactly what the Supreme Court says in its ruling.
Well, meanwhile, these so-called clean teams who go in and clean up previous information that might have been gotten during waterboarding, sanitizing it, according to one of the lawyers for the detainees. Do we know how much of this is going on?
I don't think we do, Robin. The Department of Defense and the White House has acknowledged that this is going on at Guantanamo Bay. Some reporters have mentioned that they are aware that different detainees have been talked to and statements made that may be consistent with what they did under coercion or perhaps even torture with the purpose of using it in the military commission. But how many detainees are involved, I don't think we know yet.
Yeah. And do we know how this evidence might be treated at trial? A little while back, we spoke with Brigadier General Thomas Hartman. He's the Pentagon's legal advisor on the military commissions. We asked him whether evidence obtained through waterboarding would be allowed in the upcoming trials. Let's listen.
You wait until you have the trial, and you allow the judge who's in the courtroom with the defense counsel, however many there are, you allow them to challenge the evidence that the prosecution puts forward. The prosecution understands its burden of proof and its burden in connection with the rules of admissibility for the evidence, and they know what they've got to do to try to prove their cases beyond a reasonable doubt.
Of course, we were hoping he'd say yes or no as to whether or not evidence obtained through waterboarding would be allowed in trial. Our interpretation is that he's saying it depends on the judge?
That's correct, Robin. The whole issue is waterboarding torture under the law? If it's torture, the Act of Congress prohibits any statement taken under torture from ever being admitted. If it's something less than torture, if waterboarding is cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment and not torture, which is a higher level of coercion, then it depends on when the statement was taken. If it was taken before December of 2005, the judge perhaps can let it in under a lesser standard than after that date. So this is going to be litigated in the military commission, but ultimately the military judge will have to make a ruling on the amount of coercion involved in the taking of these statements, and how he rules will then determine whether the statements come into evidence or not.
And by the way, remind us, why that date?
That's the date of the McCain Amendment to the Detainee Treatment Act, Robin. That's when the Senate passed and the president signed a statement that prohibited the use of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment against anyone in detention by the United States anywhere in the world.
Well, and of course, as if it weren't complicated enough, we also know that President Bush issued a signing statement after that legislation was passed saying that he could override it.
That's correct, Robin. We don't know whether he's done that. That will surely bring a court test, but he did raise a red flag when he signed that.
Well, and it sounds as if the second question is whether re-interviews after waterboarding, when you already have the information and you go back to the detainee and try to get him to say it again, do you think that's going to be a challenge in the trials?
I think it will, Robin. I think these defense lawyers are very zealous for their clients, and I think the defense lawyer is going to say it's all one interview and therefore it should be barred. The government's going to come in and say, no, they're two separate interviews. We separated the detainee. We told him up front that we were starting from scratch. We treated him gently and in accordance with the Geneva Convention. And again, it's going to be up to the judge to start the ruling.
Right. That's the third question. And by the way, Professor Silliman, it sounds as if there's a fourth question. Do we know that if these gentle interrogations with Starbucks coffee got the same information that was gotten after waterboarding? And if so, why not just do the soft interrogation first?
Well, Robin, a lot of people are asking that question. That's the big debate in this country is why do we need to have such coercive measures when the Department of Defense and its interrogators for years has been using methods that were consistent with international law and the Geneva Convention.
But have you heard any scuttlebutt? I mean, have any of these clean teams with offering a cup of coffee gotten the same information that was gotten through waterboarding?
Well, at least from what we are hearing through certain sources, some in the media, the statements are coming out the same. But again, a defense lawyer is going to challenge these statements in court and say, for the detainee, he's already spoken once under great duress, perhaps torture, then why should he then say, well, I'm not going to talk to you? He may not understand our legal system. He doesn't understand what's going on. This is the argument. And therefore, the defense lawyers are saying he doesn't realize that he has a right not to talk now because his first statement is not admissible.
Scott Silliman, Executive Director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University Law School, and as we said, a former military attorney. Professor Silliman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll hear never-before-heard lectures by poet Robert Frost. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Did you know that you can extract your own DNA with a few household ingredients? You can also wash your clothes with chestnuts, make plastic in your frying pan, and extract the iron out of your breakfast cereal.
It's a particularly good cereal, and it's because it's particularly crunchy.
Yeah, this is very hard work.
It is hard work, and actually you can cheat and use a kitchen blender.
Just one of many science projects in the new book, How to Fossilize Your Hamster and Other Amazing Experiments for the Armchair Scientist. It's a compilation of experiments from the magazine New Scientist. Mick O'Hare is the author. He's also the production editor for New Scientist magazine. He joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
And here in the studio, we have Ivan Semenek. He's the Boston Bureau Chief for New Scientist, and he appears in a number of the videos the magazine has put together. And we heard some of you smashing cereal to extract iron. So, Mick, let's start with that. Extract your iron from cereal.
We came up with an experiment whereby we mush up the breakfast cereal, apply a magnet, and you can actually yank out the iron from your breakfast cereal.
It looks like sort of a gray dust or something.
It does, yeah, but it's really in there, you know, and you're actually eating. As Ivan says, I think, in the video, you know, if somebody offered you a teaspoon of iron, you wouldn't want to eat it, but it's right there in your breakfast cereal.
Huh. And in fact, you know what, we'll link to your website so people can find some of these experiments there, but most are ones you can do with a few household items. One, and it's the title experiment, How to Fossilize Your Hamster. And it does say in the instructions, in fact, one of the instructions is wait till your hamster has died of natural causes.
Of course, yes. We thought we'd better specify that because you see some children running home.
It's a pride issue. Just imagine if you could have your hamster in a museum millions of years from now.
Well, that's the point. You caution, especially young people, this is going to take a long time. You're not going to see a fossilized hamster in your lifetime. But if you do want to make sure that your hamster is fossilized, you have to bury a deceased hamster in a place where the animal won't be dug up. The optimal conditions would be a desert wadi in the flash flood season or a tropical river floodplain during heavy rain.
That's right, or deep-sea mud. Deep-sea mud is good.
Deep-sea mud is good. Hard to get the hamster down there, and you have to stay away from subduction zones. You just have to avoid plate tectonics at all costs.
So that's one of those that now you know how. Whether or not you can is another thing. But there are so many that you can do. For instance, with just a few handy items, you can extract your own DNA. Ivan, tell me about that.
Oh, it is amazing that you can do this. You do a little bit of a scraping of your cheek cells, and you get them into a solution. And as any biologist can tell you, there are certain solvents you can add, like you need a little bit of liquid detergent, for example, to break down the cell membranes and get into the nucleus of your cells. And then once you do, you can actually isolate the DNA. And I've seen my own DNA dangling in the glass there, and it's quite profound.
Well, let's move on to how you can measure the speed of light with a microwave and a chocolate bar. How do we do this?
There are these electromagnetic waves in your microwave that actually excite the water molecules in the food, which is what heats it up. And, you know, these waves are standing waves. You know, they have crests and troughs, so there's certain parts of the microwave that are getting more of the energy than others. And that's actually why most microwaves have a little turntable, just so that the food kind of gets evenly moved around so that it's not cold on one side and hot on another side. But if you can take out the turntable, take a chocolate bar, you'll find that if it's not turning around, not moving in the microwave, some parts of the chocolate will melt faster than or sooner than the other parts. And you can measure the separation between the hot spots in the chocolate, which actually gives you the wavelength of the light. And meanwhile, you have on the back of the microwave the frequency of those waves. And with a little mathematical equation, it's very easy to get the speed of light.
Well, I just want to talk about one last one that our listeners can actually do within the hour if they can get their hands on a pear and an apple. You call it apple fool, and you ask, is it true that you can fool yourself into believing you are eating something other than the food that's in your mouth? Mick, you have us demonstrate that you actually can, and all we need is a sliced pear, our noses, a sliced apple, and our mouths. What do we do?
You need to put the apple in your mouth. Now, apple is a similar texture to pear. You place the pear under your nose while you're chewing the apple, and you will convince yourself that you're eating pear, because when we receive flavor, it's actually passing up from our mouths up the back of our noses, and that's the flavor we perceive. So put an apple in your mouth, pear under your nose, you'll think you're eating a pear.
That's Mick O'Hare, author of How to Fossilize Your Hamster and Other Amazing Experiments for the Armchair Scientist. We also spoke with Ivan Semenek, the Boston Bureau Chief for New Scientist magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, when an author's true story might have been as compelling as the lie she told, in 1 minute, here and now. The New York Times reports today that Margaret Jones, author of a critically acclaimed gang memoir, is actually Margaret Seltzer. And she was not a white foster child raised by black gang members in South Central Los Angeles. She grew up in a well-to-do suburb with her biological family. Well, Margaret's hoax comes fast on the heels of another one. Misha DeFonseca has admitted that her book, Misha, a memoir of the Holocaust years, the purported record of her travels as a child across Europe, searching for her Jewish parents after they were taken by the Nazis, living among wolves to survive, is not true. And Misha says it's a story her publisher convinced her to write. Her publisher is Jane Daniel. She originally published the book in the U.S. in 1997 and then landed on the losing side of a 10-year court battle with both Misha DeFonseca and her co-writer Vera Lee. They won a multi-million dollar settlement against Jane Daniel, accusing her of not properly shepherding the book. They went on and published it in Europe, where it became a bestseller and the subject of a movie. How did this happen? Well, publisher Jane Daniel joins us in the studio. Jane, you and Misha are both here in New England. When did you first hear her story?
Misha had been telling her Holocaust experiences to small groups for several years before I actually met her. We began to talk about writing a book. I think she was very anxious to tell this story.
We should say that Misha DeFonseca and her husband Maurice are from Belgium. They moved to the U.S. in 1988 to the New England area here.
That's correct.
And as you said, by the 90s, she was telling her stories. A difference of opinion on how the story came to be a book. She says you pressed her. You say she seemed eager. But what was your reaction when you heard these stories?
When you're dealing with Holocaust literature, what you have to understand is much of what you read is so bizarre. There were unbelievable stories at the end of the war where these wraith figures, who were nothing but skin and bones, in black and white striped pajamas and no shoes, marched through sub-freezing, snowy territory. They were the death marches, and some of those people survived. So when you judge somebody who's a Holocaust survivor, you're very reluctant to say this cannot be, because I've said before, there's a quality of the miraculous about anybody who survived.
And yet, you still consulted Holocaust experts who read the manuscript and pointed out to you what they said were errors, and you went ahead and published it anyway.
The people right now who are congratulating themselves for having spotted errors are the same people who, during the last 10 years, didn't speak it again at all. Now that she's confessed that it's a hoax, everybody is saying, well, I knew it was a hoax. But at the time, there were many people who supported her. She had been speaking in the Jewish community for quite a few years.
Well, then, both Misha DeFonseca and her co-author, Vera Lee, sue you. They accuse you of withholding royalties, of having offshore accounts, of not advertising the book in the U.S. as you promised. And you lose, not once, but twice. You lose on appeal. And by the way, what were the damages against you?
Totally, it was $33 million.
What was your response, by the way, to the accusations?
My response has always been that Mount Ivy paid and accounted for every dime that came in.
So we move on from that chapter, and after you lose those lawsuits, you also lost the American publishing rights. What's your thinking about that now?
I think Misha had a motive to kill the American book, and that is because the American book contained the name that she truly was raised with, which was also her father's name, DeWall. When she said she had been given the false identity of Monique DeWall.
And as it turns out, that is
that was her real name.
After you lost the publishing rights in the U.S., they did not ever republish the book in the U.S., but published it in Europe and changed the names.
And changed the name.
After you lose the lawsuit, you begin your own research into Misha's life. You started a blog. You posted information. You asked for scholars who might be interested in helping you out. Because why? You were angry you lost the lawsuit?
After the case ended, David Mohegan, who had been at one time the book editor of the Boston Globe, wrote an article. He was the first journalist who publicly questioned the authenticity of the book. After that, another journalist, Blake Eskin, publicly questioned it. In 10 years, those are the only two journalists that have questioned the authenticity of the book. However, that was enough for me to start saying, well, perhaps it was truly a hoax. And if that were the case, then that might give me an opportunity to have the judgment reversed.
So you have one scholar in particular who is intrigued by your proposition. She consults people in Belgium and finds out what about Misha DeFonseca?
She found that she had been born in Belgium in Etterbeek in 1937 on May 12th. And that she was Catholic.
And here's where it gets even more interesting. Research was indicating that Misha's background was actually Catholic, that her parents were resistors who had perhaps been arrested and deported and killed. But now, The Belgium newspaper is reporting what about her father?
Misha's father, he was in the resistance, but he had sold out his comrades to the Gestapo.
There are so many questions on Misha's side, on the author's side, but on your side, people are saying, well, yes, all of this has been revealed, but why did you wait till you lost, you know, millions? You had millions in damages against you. Why did you wait until then to do this investigation?
My answer to that is a publisher is not in the business of vetting the truthfulness of what they publish. In a standard publishing contract, the author warrants that the facts, statements of fact in the manuscript are true and authentic. Misha and her co-author warranted that to the publisher. That's the publisher's responsibility to get that warranty. But beyond that, it is the marketplace in a free society that vets the truthfulness. Otherwise, you're asking the publisher to make decisions like, well, shall I publish Hillary Clinton's view of the political spectrum, or should I publish George Bush's view? Publishers don't make those decisions.
Well, but it's understood that at publishing houses there are proofreaders, there are people who do research. They will ask people, well, this doesn't jive with this, and you're saying...
I'm saying that what I did was do the fact-checking, but here was the conundrum. Misha said she had lost her identity during the war, so I didn't have a name, I didn't have a date of birth. There was no personal information whatsoever in the book that I could fact-check.
While Misha DeFonseca has said through her lawyer that the story that she told is not actual reality, but was my reality, my way of surviving... What she said was, parents who were Nazi resistors, members of the Belgian resistance movement. This might have been her way to deal with an excruciatingly painful past and truth. I mean, do you have some sympathy for her?
It's not my place to have sympathy. The question that has to be asked is, does it matter whether or not something is the truth or not? I had no evidence one way or another, but once the book got to Europe, there were people on the ground there who had access to certain records that they could have done the investigation. Nobody caught the fraud. Nobody caught the fraud.
But what do you want to have happen? I mean, there's, some would say, some vindication for you, perhaps, in that now this woman isn't as enshrined as she was. But do you want the verdict overturned? I mean, what do you want?
I do. I want the judgment overturned. Because I think it was acquired through fraud.
Well, the Boston Globe reports that publishing law experts say too much time has passed since the judgment against you to challenge it now. And the lawyer for Misha's co-author, Vera Lee, who I understand was a friend of yours before all of this, who won the settlement against you, the lawyer says he questions your motives now in this research and is going after your assets, which could be, you know, your home.
I don't know why he would even mention my motives. The fact is, Misha herself confessed to being a hoax. Where are my motives in there?
Well, you know, some would say you knowingly published something thinking, you know, there'd be a windfall in it, and the damages against you might be, you know, a comeuppance.
Again, if I had known that it was a hoax, would I have waited 10 years to speak up after I lost? I think that when the dust settles, what people have to do is differentiate between the story, which I believe still is a beautiful story. It has a message of hope. It has the right moral tone in terms of condemning the Nazis. I think people are afraid that if they have to acknowledge that the story is not true, they have to give up the story. You can keep the story and condemn the lie that it was the truth.
Jane Daniel, original publisher of Misha, A Memoir of the Holocaust Years. The author recently admitted the story was a complete hoax. Jane, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.